Okay, so our last of the three talks in this session on physical sciences, the future of faith and philosophy of science, is by my Trinity Western colleague, Bob Wood, professor of physics there, and it is called Faith, Integration, and the Unification Paradigm in Theoretical Physics.
Thanks, Arnold. Thank you for being here. I thank the meeting organizers for the opportunity to speak to you about unification in theoretical physics. Those of us that are physicists are well-versed with the idea of understanding nature better by taking disparate features of nature and bringing them together in a common framework and advancing our knowledge in this way. So I'm going to give some history of the unification, what I'm calling here a unification paradigm, and then I'll relate that to the topic that we're interested in our schools, unification of faith and learning. So a little bit about the unification paradigm. Gary's talk and mine synchronize quite well together. I'll quote Wigner as well, in the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics. Why is it that mathematics should always, in many ways, relate well to the description of the physical world? Another feature of the unification paradigm is the ability of physicists to imagine a world of symmetrical states when we live in a world where those symmetries are not realized. A willingness to suspend our common sense is part of the unification paradigm. This is manifest very well in terms of relativity and quantum mechanics. No matter what faith perspective theoretical physicists held, there's often a deep sense of awe and wonder in the mysteries of nature and in the mathematical beauty that is realized in the best descriptions of nature. So here's some historical examples. I'll try to run through these fairly quickly. Beginning with the Greeks and their atom idea that all different forms of material matter can be described in terms of atoms. Aristotle used five elements. Archimedes contributed much to theoretical physics, but the point that I'll make here is that he recognized that mathematical models could have an application in describing the physical world, and of course, Occam's razor. In doing this research over the last year on sabbatical, I was very interested to discover that coming out of COVID, that Newton, when he was admitted into Cambridge, wasn't particularly a star student, but he got sent home for 2 years for risk of the plague. And so he worked from home, self-isolating. And during that time period, apparently, he had a very productive reflection on physical world, and that was very helpful in his development of his theories. Freeman Dyson says the very greatest scientists in each discipline are unifiers. This is especially true in physics. Newton and Einstein were supreme unifiers. And of course, Newton, with his Principia, published the three laws of physics and the law of gravitation that unified not only motions of objects on Earth, but also the celestial bodies. Faraday is, as we know, he was a great experimentalist, but not well versed in mathematics, or higher order mathematics. He's a very interesting figure, and if you haven't seen Murray Watt's play, I would highly recommend you taking that in. Faraday recognized experimentally that changing a magnetic field through a coil produces a current in the coil, linking magnetic and electric properties. He also recognized that magnetic fields affect the polarization of light, and in 1851 published a paper on the possible relation of gravity to electricity. And while he recognized that this was not valid, the predictions of the paper weren't valid, he went ahead and published it anyway. Maxwell, who was well-versed in math, delivered a paper on Faraday's lines of force. and formulated his 20 differential equations, which in its published form included the displacement current that enabled him to develop equations that predicted that light is an electromagnetic wave. So this is a great step forward in unification of not only electricity and magnetism, electricity and magnetic fields, but light is also an electromagnetic phenomenon. Now, Einstein came along and he recognized that there was this problem between Newton's unification and Maxwell's unification, in that Maxwell predicted that light was a constant, a fundamental constant of nature, and Newton's theory predicted that the light would depend on the motion of the emitter. So Einstein postulated that speed of light is independent of the motion of the emitting body and came up with his special theory of relativity, wherein he unified space and time into space-time and mass and energy. Einstein also had a problem with Newton's theory of gravitation, in that the Newton's theory of gravitation is dependent upon the masses of two bodies and their separation, but it contains no time dependence. And so if the mass or the distance were to change suddenly, then Newton's gravitational equation predicts an instantaneous action at distance, which was an anathema to Einstein. So in 1915, after significant work, Einstein published his paper of general relativity, where he unified space-time and gravitation. So now the curvature of space-time influences gravitation, and the presence of matter affects the curvature of space-time. Chandrasekhar wrote a very, very fine paper where he says, "I shall consider why a study of the general theory of relativity conduces in one a feeling not dissimilar to one's feeling after seeing a play of Shakespeare or hearing a symphony of Beethoven." Einstein's theory of gravitation, of course, had cosmological implications, and it was soon recognized that we live in an expanding universe. You play the tape backwards, and this leads to the Big Bang, where you have quantum high-energy effects that quantum mechanics is needed. And in the development of the theories of particle physics and quantum mechanics, there's a number of contributors to the unification aspects of these theories. Dirac was a significant player in this regard. He published a theory on the emission and absorption of radiation, the foundation piece of quantum electrodynamics, QED, and where the photon is the mediating force of the electromagnetic field. And he also published his Dirac equation that brought in elements of special relativity, quantum mechanics, and electricity and magnetism. And so this is the beginning of, in 1928, the unification of particles and fields. And it paved the way for quantum field theory. In terms of particle physics, where there really is some spectacular results in terms of the unification, at the core of this is, along with quantum field theory, gauge theory. A gauge theory is represented when a system has a symmetry and it's invariant under particular operation, and this is done in a local manner in keeping with special relativity. So the simplest example of this is quantum electrodynamics, where the photons mediate the electromagnetic force between charged particles. And the symmetry group here is the unitary group involving the phase of the wave function. So after the development of the gauge theory approach to the electromagnetic field, QED, there was a desire to try to see if some of the other forces of nature, the weak or strong nuclear forces, could be brought into this approach. Yang and Mills proposed a gauge theory of the strong nuclear force using a more sophisticated group. but their result predicted charged massless particles. And it was known that these particles didn't exist. But they went ahead and published the paper anyway because they're beautiful, the idea that they felt that the idea was so beautiful. And there were, over the space of a couple of decades, a number of contributors to what became the electroweak theory, building from Yang and Mills. Julian Schwinger proposed using the group for the weak nuclear force with mediating particles of the photon and W plus and W minus particles. Sheldon Glashow elaborated the group and brought in honor of the 50th anniversary of CSEA, the Z particle. And Steven Weinberg and Salam incorporated spontaneous symmetry breaking into the equation in order that the W and Z particles would have mass. And this was the symmetry breaking involves the Higgs field. The Higgs field is proposed to be present in the universe, and in the very early universe, there was, at sufficient energies, symmetry so that the electric and weak nuclear force are part and parcel of the same thing. As the universe expands and cools, the symmetry is broken, and then you have disparate electric and weak nuclear forces. So, by the mid-1970s, the standard model is becoming well established. It is a theory of the electromagnetic weak and strong nuclear force. It's based on symmetries associated with the gauge field theory. It accounts for known particles and predicts some new particles, and those new particles are eventually discovered in the years in brackets. Now, this generates a lot of optimism, a lot of support for what I'm calling unification paradigm. But there are some disconcerting pieces that remain. One, the proton decay hasn't been observed. There are some cosmological challenges. Supersymmetry was brought in at some point in order to try and alleviate some of the things, but the superpartners haven't been discovered. And this doesn't say anything about the unification of the fourth fundamental force of gravity. Arguably, progress has stalled out in the unification paradigm in the last few decades, and this might suggest that what we're missing is some element of mathematical beauty. So, now I'm going to change gears from that brief historical summary to the motivation for the unification paradigm. I love this quote from Dirac. A good deal of my research work in physics has consisted in not setting out to solve some particular problem, but simply examining mathematical quantities of a kind that physicists use and trying to fit them together in an interesting way, regardless of any application that the work may have. It is simply a search for pretty mathematics. It may turn out later that the work does have an application. Then one has had good luck. Famous quote from Wigner, also put up by Gary. This is a correspondence from Heisenberg to Einstein. If nature leads us to mathematical forms of great simplicity and beauty, we cannot help thinking that they are true, that they reveal a genuine feature of nature. You must have felt this too, the almost frightening simplicity and wholeness of the relationships which nature suddenly spreads out before us and for which none of us was in the least prepared. Einstein gave this quote. This is in an article that I give a reference at the end of the talk. The most beautiful and deepest experience a man can have is the sense of the mysterious. It is the underlying principle of religion, as well as all serious endeavor in art and science. He who never had this experience seems to me, if not dead, then at least blind. T- to sense that behind anything that can be experienced, there is something that our mind cannot grasp, and whose beauty and sublimity reaches us only indirectly, and as a feeble reflection. This is religiousness. We might say this is looking through a glass darkly. In this sense, I am religious. To me, it suffices to wonder at these secrets and to attempt humbly to grasp with my mind a mere image of the lofty structure of all that is there. Now I'm going to change gears to the distinctiveness of what I'm calling the unification paradigm. So the paradigm in science comes from Thomas Kuhn in his book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, where he talks about normal science. And this is work that's done for a period of time, typically several decades, within a distinct framework. And then after a period of time, it may be the case that some revolutionary science takes place and the paradigm shifts and the scientist's perception of his environment must be re-educated. Examples of scientific paradigms over the span of history that I'm giving are listed here. Easily there's 9 or 10 paradigms. In contrast to Kuhn's paradigms, which have a limited lifespan, the unification paradigm has been present throughout this extended period of time. One might ask, why would the unification paradigm persist for several thousand years, all of the time that people have been studying nature? Perhaps the underlying reason is that the unification paradigm is not rooted in human constructs, but in God's eternal nature that is evident in creation. And we're familiar with Romans 1:20, ever since the creation of the world, his eternal power and divine nature, invisible though they are, have been understood and seen through the things he has made. And in Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God and the skies proclaim the work of his hands. With regard to mathematical beauty, one thing I asked from the Lord, this only do I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze on the beauty of the Lord and to seek him in his temple. The Catholic theologian Hans-Urs von Balthasar has said, may it not be that we have a real and inescapable obligation to prove the possibility of there being a genuine relationship between theological beauty and the beauty of the world. Alistair McGrath has written extensively on this topic, and in his book, The Open Secret, he writes, an emphatic assertion of the beauty of the world and its theological importance is found in most writers of the patristic and medieval periods, who celebrated this beauty as something that was intrinsically delightful, while at the same time affirming its potential to lead those questing for a fuller disclosure of that beauty to discover its source and culmination in God. So as Gary pointed out, a lot of the early scientists were devout Christians. This developed into what we often call natural theology. Barth was very critical of natural theology, and Alistair McGrath has written the following: a Christian natural theology celebrates and articulates the half-grasped rational transparency and oblique beauty of a complex and multifaceted nature, while at the same time proclaiming that a greater beauty lies beyond its horizon. A Christian natural theology is, in its own distinctive way, a theology of hope, a means of sustaining us as we travel through this sign-studded world, reassuring us that there is indeed a big picture which we presently grasp only in part. And again, from McGrath, my approach recognizes that the Christian faith naturally gives rise to a way of looking at the natural world shaped by the Christian imaginarium, which is not seen as the basis of faith or as a source for our knowledge of God, but rather as the consequence of that knowledge. As such, it allows a theory-laden observation of the natural world which is informed by the distinctive Trinitarian ontology of the Christian faith, which is not limited to cognitive or conceptual analysis, but extends to include effective relational and existential issues. So I'm proposing here that the unification paradigm is not seen as the basis of faith or as a source of knowledge of our God, but that it provides a connection between the glory of God and the mathematical beauty of those theories that best describe creation. And in this regard, it serves as a guidepost to the theoretical physicist. The unification paradigm is an example, I'm proposing, of a genuine relationship between the theological beauty and the beauty of the world as anticipated by von Balthasar. Now, following the Enlightenment, the privilege of the Christian theology fell to the side, and there became a mindset that there was opposition to Christian perspective based on reason and science. And by the 20th century, a number of groups responded to this opposition to the Christian faith, including the ASA that was established in 1941 to support science teachers. And 50 years ago, the CSCA, which was established to address unique challenges in the Canadian context. A number of individuals also started to try to wrestle with how Christians could be put into the marketplace of science. And people like Billy Graham, Arthur Holmes, Walter Storff, a number of leaders put some things into place that eventually led to the establishment of the CCCU to provide a unified voice representing the interests and concerns of Christian colleges to government decision makers and the general public. I had the privilege as a new faculty member to go to a faith integration seminar and meet people like Arthur Holmes. Arthur Holmes described faith integration as a lifelong struggle to see things whole, to think and become more consistently what we profess. A lifelong struggle to see things whole reflects well the motivation of the unification paradigm to see things whole and to identify mathematical beauty with truth. To think and become more consistently what we profess, recall McGrath's Trinitarian ontology of a Christian natural theology. Mark Knoll argues in Jesus Christ and the Life of the Mind that the great hope for Christian learning is to delve deeper into the Christian faith itself, learning more of Jesus Christ. Knoll goes on to describe Christ as the paradigm and the telos of all that is beautiful. So, the unification paradigm holds dearly to see things whole, associates mathematical beauty with truth, and based on its timeless nature, it seems that it serves as a guidepost that points fundamental physical theories towards God's beauty. Perhaps there are other examples of ways that God's beauty serves scholarly endeavors. One could think of the fine arts. And perhaps there are other guideposts that are useful to scholars. And I'll close with a beautiful expression of faith integration by Maxwell, one of our examples of a great unifier. Omnipotent God, who has created man in your image and has made him a living spirit so that he can seek and have power over your creatures, teach us to study the work of your hands in such a way that we can subject the earth to our use and strengthen our reason in your service and receive your blessed word so as to have faith in the one whom you have sent to give knowledge of salvation and the remission of our sins. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your talk. In your slide on the standard model, you talked about how there's been a sort of lack of breakthrough progress. And the line you had in that slide was, maybe there's some missing beautiful mathematics. What if there's some missing ugly mathematics? This assumption that the mathematics involved in physics needs to be beautiful mathematics, as much as it has great sort of alignment with our theology, remains an assumption. And I'm a mathematician, so I'm going to get the physics wrong here. But the standard model requires, or at least the string theory behind it, requires some manifold with some geometry, Calabi-Yau or otherwise. And someone thought, well, maybe there are just a few of these. And then they sent us mathematicians to go off and classify them. And we found about 500,000. Sorry about that. But maybe we have to just, you know, live with the fact that it's encoded in a list of the invariants of all 500,000 of these, which is a particularly non-elegant mathematics. So your thoughts on whether or not it might turn out to be sort of ugly mathematics that gets us through.
Yeah, great question. I guess my response would be, looking back in time, the most significant advances have been when a theory that has been constructed mathematically that is elegant, simple, and beauty has brought us the farthest in terms of our understanding of nature. So, based on historical precedent, there is a bias towards mathematical beauty, and I would say that we currently don't have a theory that is a theory of everything, has brought in gravitation, and some of those theories are proposed theories are based on maybe not so beautiful mathematics. But the fact that they haven't provided a satisfactory explanation of gravitation and quantum mechanics suggests that maybe we still have farther to go to find something, and maybe that something would prove to be a mathematically beautiful theory.
Your examples are relatively modern, but I was thinking of Pythagoras in the 5th century BC, his idea of music of the spheres. Again, there was a mathematical idea behind that, and again, it was the beauty of the math that seemed to be the constant motivation. For example, to his knowledge, the spacing of the planets was the same as the intervals of a music scale, and therefore he thought it was beautiful music. So in my book, Beauty in Science and Spirit, I go back to that and wonder makes you think that why not say from mystical beauty of, say, Pythagoras, a very primitive understanding for us, but nevertheless a motivation for it all.
Thanks for that additional example. And certainly I just had to pick and choose as I went, but there are many. And I did err on the side of the more modern theories for sure.
Thanks. I thought it was a very nice survey of modern physics and all the stuff I do, which I like. But I have a bit of sympathy with the first question here. And one of the things that's quite new is in the last 40 years, we've had an enormous number of people working on the unification of gravity with quantum physics, and they haven't succeeded. And they've tried, I don't know how many different kinds of purportedly beautiful mathematical models. It's not working. And as you pointed out, what was touted as the most beautiful, namely supersymmetry, the empirical evidence is against it. Does this make you worry a little bit?
I would say that we may be reaching our human capacity of understanding God's beauty on this side of heaven. That still leaves me to believe that we should keep trying.
I agree. We give up.
Yeah.
Still,
yeah.
It's curious.
Robinson. Yes, mystery. We've had kind of talks about mystery and accepting mystery. And we shouldn't accept mystery too quickly, I guess. We still want to dig into it and try to plumb the depths. So thanks to all our speakers. And